Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning. You are all welcome to this webinar hosted by Birungi Barat & Associates. Birungi Barat & Associates is a legal and tax consultancy firm that offers tax advisory services on domestic, international tax, tax planning, audit, consultancy, litigation, among others. Today's webinar is on tax cases that have changed the tax landscape in Uganda. These are matters that have been handled by the firm and were concluded in the year 2019. My name is Jackie Aturinda, and I will be moderating this session together with Ms. Karunji Amandla. Please welcome our panelists for today, Mr. Birungi Cephas, Ms. Belinda Nachiganda Rutaya, Ms. Dorothy Shagenda, and Mr. Kamsime Oscar. Before we officially start, we have a few housekeeping rules. To all our panelists and attendees, please mute your microphones if you're not speaking. And to our attendees, we request that you turn off your videos. And then in case you have any questions, please use the Q&A window at the bottom of your screen. We shall attend to the questions. At the end of all the presentations, we shall have a Q&A session. So we shall attend to your questions. I'll now hand over to Ms. Karunji Amandla to introduce our first speaker. Over to you, Amandla.
Thank you, Jackie. Thank you for joining us in this tax webinar. Our first speaker is Ms. Belinda Nachiganda Lutaya. She's an advocate and a tax practitioner. She has been in practice for over 10 years. She's going to discuss how the courts have interpreted the law in regard to VAT on educational materials. VAT is an indirect tax charged on certain goods. And in relation to educational materials, the law has transformed. And in accordance with the cases that she's going to talk about, she'll give us more insight on how it has been interpreted in regard to exempt tax, zero rated supplies, and standard rated supplies. Belinda, over to you. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining this webinar. Today I'm tasked with talking about tax treatment of educational materials. But let me first talk a little bit about value-added tax and customs tax. Value-added tax in Uganda is governed by the Value-Added Tax Act, CAP 349, and it's tax charged on goods and services bought, sold for use or consumption. And in Uganda, VAT is charged on taxable supplies. We have three bands of supplies in Uganda. The first band is exempt supplies. This means that there is no tax rate that is imposed on these services or supply or goods. Then we have zero rated supplies, which means that the tax rate that is imposed on these supplies is 0%. And then we have standard rated supplies, which means that on these supplies, 18% VAT is chargeable. For zero rated and standard rated supplies, a taxpayer may have to register for VAT if their turnover is over 150 million in a year of income. For exempt supplies, you don't have to register since the supplies are exempt. If you're dealing in a mixture of exempt, zero rated, and standard rated, you may still be eligible to register for VAT. So that is for the VAT. And then Customs Act, the Customs Act is actually governed by the East Africa Community Customs Management Act of 2004. And this is import duty. Import duty is charged on goods from outside Uganda for either home use or transit. For this webinar, we are going to concentrate on goods brought in for home use. If goods are brought in for home use, they are solely used for purposes of for sale or for personal use in Uganda. So if they are bought in for, and then import duty is chargeable. Usually import duty customs duty comprises of import duty, VAT, and withholding tax. With that, let's get to the next slide and we talk about the cases we're going to discuss today. In the last 2 years, there's been a debate on what comprises of educational materials, because when you say educational materials, it is a wide concept, and which materials are eligible for educational materials and which ones are not. We have two cases which the tribunal has actually decided and which can guide on these principles. The first case is the Gastro case. In Gastro, Gastro is a company that imports goods, mainly educational books, study materials, textbooks, charts, catalogs, and similar leisure books and literature books. And once they import them into Uganda, then they sell them to educational institutes. URA carried out an audit on Gastro and recharacterized the VAT that Gastro declared at import from exempt to standard rated, and also recharacterized the VAT that Gastro was charging on the sale of the leisure books and literature books in Uganda from zero rated to standard rated. Gastro was aggrieved by this decision, and they went before the Tax Appeals Tribunal. If you can go to the next slide, please. In the Tax Appeals Tribunal, the applicant, Gastro's arguments were actually that the goods once imported don't attract any tax as per the East African Custom Management Act and the Flores Agreement. And then they also argued that once the goods are in Uganda and they are sold to the educational institutes, they attract 0% rate, which is zero rated as per the VAT Act. URA on the other side disagreed, stating that Gastro had misinterpreted the Customs Act and therefore misclassified the goods at import as exempt, yet they should have been standard rated, and also misclassified the goods under VAT when they are locally supplied as zero rated instead of standard rated. And their reasoning was that under Section 24 and the third schedule of the VAT Act, it says that educational materials should be only used for educational purposes or public libraries. And in this case, the library, the literature books and the leisure books that Gastro was bringing in could not be used solely for educational purposes, and thus they make it standard rated supplies. The issue to be decided by the tribunal was whether the leisure books and literature books that Gastro brings in are subject to tax at zero rate, are exempt, or they are standard rated. The tribunal made a ruling, and the tribunal first said that Section 20 of the VAT Act provides that imported goods are exempt under the VAT Act if they are also exempt under the Customs Act. And in that Section 20, the tribunal said that there are two scenarios. The first scenario is importing goods, and the second one is selling goods locally in Uganda. So we're going to first deal with the supply of local sales in Uganda. The tribunal looked at Section 24 and said that the URA shouldn't look at the word only for educational purposes when interpreting the schedule. That what should be actually looked at is whether the goods are suitable for use in educational institutes or public libraries. They interpreted suitable for use to mean fit for purpose. And in that regard, say that are these goods then suit for purpose for use in educational services? The tribunal was of the view that since it's the leisure books and literature books, they may not necessarily all fall into the category of educational materials, since educational materials are limited to textbooks and materials which are used for educational purposes. Yet some of these literature books are like novels, which may not fall into the curriculum or for educational purposes. So they say that all the leisure books and literature books may not fall under educational materials. Then they went on to see, are these goods fit for purpose for public libraries? And they said that once that the act meant that public libraries should be a general library and not a private library. So if these leisure books are taken to a public library, anyone can access them. And different people go with different interests in public libraries. What I like may not be liked by other people, but they might like another educational or leisure book that can actually educate them. So the tribunal found that the books, the leisure books and literature books that Gastro was bringing in were actually fit for purpose for public use. But it's also crucial to note that the tribunal made an exception for what suitable, fit for purpose includes. They say that fit for purpose or suitable for use does not include goods or books that are offensive, such as seditious books, that those that promote violence, immorality, and if as someone brings them in, then they don't amount to educational material or fit for purpose for public use. And also the tribunal stated that even if the goods are used, even if these books are used for both educational purposes and non-educational purposes, it doesn't take away the purpose of the books, that they are fit and suitable for use. So the tribunal held in favor of Gastro, stating that these books attract a zero rate of tax. In terms of goods at import, the tribunal looked at section 114 of the East Africa Customs Act and also the fifth schedule, wherein the tribunal stated that it is clear that this act exempts educational materials and books at import. And then they also looked at the Florence Agreement, which the respondent said doesn't apply in Uganda. And the tribunal was like, this Florence Agreement was actually ratified by Uganda and inserted in the East Africa Customs Management Act in 2005, and therefore it applies in Uganda. And it's applicable in this case. They also found that the Florence Agreement is actually wider and interprets educational materials and services in a wider scope than even the Customs Act in Uganda. And they said, so someone bringing other educational materials can actually fall under that at import. So the tribunal ruled that at importation, these educational materials are exempt from custom and import duty. So that was the ruling of the tribunal. What is the significance of this case? The first significance is we see that the tribunal acknowledging the Florence Agreement, and that it was, which is an international agreement, and this shows that when there's a conflict between the VAT Act and an international agreement, then an international agreement prevails. Secondly, that at import, at the time of importation, these educational materials are exempt from customs duty as per the Customs Act and the Florence Agreement. Under VAT for locally charged goods, this case brought in a change in law in 2018. In paragraph 4A of the third schedule, that in that now educational materials are strictly restricted to locally produced materials suitable for education or public libraries. And the word only was also removed from that section, since the tribunal had ruled that it has to be fit for purpose and only does it isn't really crucial. This means that imported materials, Once you import educational materials and then they come on the local market in Uganda, then they are no longer zero rated. You have to charge 18% standard rated from 1st July 2018 going forward. Secondly, yes, from 1st July 2018. So that is on the Gastro case. Now let us compare it to the Pickfair case. Pickfair is a local producer and manufacturer of stationery and goods in Uganda, and it's targeted for mainly educational purposes. Pickfair had applied for a refund of VAT, and URA carried out an audit to verify this refund. Thereafter, URA issued an assessment recharacterizing A4 hardcover books, which are counter books in Uganda, are standard rated instead of zero rated. So Pickfair before was accounting for them as zero rated, but URA said no, they should be standard rated. What were Pickfair's arguments? Pickfair argued that these books, the A4 books, are in three brands, but the bronze and silver are specifically manufactured and made for educational purposes. And therefore, they should be zero-rated as per the VAT Act. They also argued that the practice notice that TRA is trying to rely on does not apply in this case since it was issued in 2018, yet Pickfair had filed its application before the Tax Appeals Tribunal in 2017. They also argued that the statutory instrument that URA was trying to rely on again of 2018 wasn't applicable in this case, since again, it came in force after Pickfair had filed its suit in 2017. URA, on the other hand, argued like in Gastro, saying the word only under the VAT Act states that it means exclusivity. So these goods must be strictly for educational purposes. And if they're used for any other purpose, then they cease to be only for educational purposes, and then they are for use for other things. So in that regard, they say that the goods are no longer exclusive, and thus they should attract 18%. The issue before the tribunal was similar to the one in Gastro, where the tribunal had to determine what rate is applicable for the A4 books in this case. The tribunal acknowledged that the A4 books can actually be used for both educational and non-educational purposes. But the tribunal said, but in this case, the tribunal brought out two issues under that section 24 and the third schedule of the VAT Act. They said they still interpreted the word suitable for use to mean fit for purpose. But at the same time, they say that you also have to look at the functionality of the books. So they went behind why these books were actually manufactured by Pickfair. And from the tests, from the evidence provided by Pickfair and also URA, the tribunal decided that these books are actually, the function of these books are for educational purposes, and they should be used for school. But then if they're used for other purposes, then those other purposes are not fit for purpose. The tribunal gave an example of the walkways on the roads. They say that walkways are put there so that people who are walking can actually use it so they avoid the incoming and ongoing traffic of the roads, of the cars on the road. But in Uganda, as you know, sometimes border borders use the walkways. So if the border borders use the walkways, does that defeat the functionality of the walkways? No, the main functionality of the walkways is that people who are walking should use it. But if the border borders use it, then they are using it for a wrong reason. So that is how they compared the A4 books in this context. And they said that the functionality of these books are for educational purposes, and therefore they are fit for purpose, for educational purposes, and therefore they should be subjected to zero rate of tax. Further, the tribunal looked at the practice notice of 2018 and decided that this practice notice is only binding on the Commissioner General and it does not create law. And the practice notice has the interpretation of the Commissioner General, but it may not necessarily be the right interpretation. And since they've decided that the A4 books are fit for purpose, then the practice notice is not binding on the taxpayers and they should take the ruling of the tribunal. In regards to the statutory instrument that URA was also relying on, the tribunal stated that these regulations came in force in 2018 after Pickfair had filed their application before the tribunal, and therefore it is not applicable in this case. But they also made a point that even if it was applicable, A4 books are actually provided for under that SI, and therefore they would be zero rated. So now we move on to the significance of the Pickfair case. The Pickfair case brought out two issues: that these books have to be one fit for purpose, but also the functionality of the material, the educational materials, has to be considered before one can make a ruling whether they are educational materials or not. A4 books, which are counter books, have been confirmed to be zero rated. Further, the tribunal emphasized the fact that practice notices are only binding on the Commissioner General and they're not law. It also clarified that the law cannot act retrospective. What does this mean? Like I said earlier, the tribunal said that the SI came out in 2018, yet the assessment in this case was for 2014 to 2017. So the tribunal said a 2018 law cannot act from 2014 to 2017. That is what it means. So in conclusion, Gastro and Pickfair, though a bit alike, they're actually, there's differences. In Gastro, they bring out the principle of when, what tax, what rate of tax applies at a particular stage. At import, it is exempt. Once it's on the local market and it's applied, then it is standard rated. So that difference has to be taken care of. And then for Pickfair, it emphasizes that if these goods are locally, Pickfair locally produces a good. So if these goods are locally produced in Uganda, then they are subjected to zero rate or tax. So anyone dealing in educational materials, you have to take care and have to take note on what tax, what rate of tax applies at what stage. Because in this discussion, we've seen there's exempt, there's zero rated, and then there's standard rated. So you have to be careful what tax you you apply so that you're not penalized by URA. Thank you so much. Amandla, that is all for me.
Thank you so much, Belinda. We have a few questions. One of them is to clarify on those words that you've been using. Someone is asking, you have seemingly used unusual terms like standard rated, zero rated, and exempt supplies. Question is coming from Gary Ivan. Would you please explain those terms just briefly again, standard rated, zero rated, and exempt supplies?
Okay, thank you, Mugabe. So, like I mentioned before, VAT is actually charged on taxable supplies. And in Uganda, there are actually two taxable supplies. That is the zero rated and standard rated. What do you mean by let's start with standard rated. What do you mean when someone says these are standard rated supplies? This means that the rate of 18% is actually charged on the supplies. So you usually notice when you go to the supermarket and you buy things, they'll give you your receipt which says that the goods were, say, 5,000 and then VAT at 18%. So that is a standard rated supply. And so you apply 18% on the supply. Then for zero rated, the supplies are taxed at 0%. So meaning, if you go again to the supermarket and they give you 5,000 and that those goods are zero rated, then the VAT chargeable on those goods will be 0% rate. Then if you say exempt supplies don't have a rate of tax at all. It is exempt, so there is no tax on them and there is no tax that is imposed. That is the difference between the three.
Thank you, Belinda. One last question, because the rest of the questions will be answered in the Q&A at the end. But one last question for you in this session is that, are there any flaws or weaknesses in the eligibility criteria for determining VAT?
Well, Amandla, that's a general question. If there are any, there's eligibility on determining the VAT criteria. It depends on what that supply is. And if you come to say BBA, then we can ask you what supply you do have, what supply are you going to make, and then we can explain to you properly what they determine or not. So I didn't really understand the question because it's general, but so it depends on the supply actually one is dealing in, and also under the VAT Act.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Belinda and Amandla. As we all know that URA has over the years employed tax administrative measures to enforce tax collection. These include third-party agency notices, distress proceedings, temporary closure of businesses, seizure of goods, among others. However, today we shall be focusing on third-party agency notices which are issued to recover tax from persons owing money to a taxpayer, and these are usually banks. The Tax Procedure Code Act under Section 31 provides for when and how such notices should be issued. However, in practice, we have seen that the taxman has sometimes proceeded outside the law, and the courts have on several occasions found that these actions are illegal. Our next presenter is Ms. Dorothy Shagenda. Dorothy is an associate partner at Birungi Berhad and Associates and has been in practice for over 10 years. She'll be addressing us on how the courts have handled this issue. Over to you, Dorothy.
Thank you, Jackie. I hope everyone is okay during this trying time of COVID. I'll go straight to the topic on agency notices. Agency notices are provided for under the Tax Procedure Code Act, and they are basically a collection measure whereby taxes are recovered through persons who owe money to the taxpayer. So the requirements under the law include that a person will be liable to pay tax or is actually liable to pay tax. The tax is unpaid. The commissioner has grounds to believe that you will not, that the taxpayer will not pay tax. That is also a requirement. As long as the commissioner thinks you will not pay tax, they can issue it. The notice has to be in writing. The notice must be served on the addressee and also on the taxpayer. It should have a date of payment, and the amount in the notice should not exceed the tax unpaid. These requirements have been brought up in some cases, which I'll refer to next. And the first one is Paramount Insurance case. Briefly, the facts were that the respondent, being an insurance company, issued out custom security bonds to various clearing agents and importers who had not paid taxes. So URA demanded for the taxes from this insurance company that had issued out the customs security bonds. The taxes were not paid by the insurance company. So what happened? URA went ahead and issued an agency notice and suspended the company from operating. The case initially was at the High Court, and at that stage, the insurance company won the case. URA later appealed. So on appeal, URA mainly relied on Section 109 of the East Africa Customs Management Act, which allows the commissioner to enforce payment of security as though it is tax that is due and unpaid. URA also argued that they had made demands to the clearing firms and payment had not been made. The respondent, who was the insurance company, argued that URA was not justified to suspend its operations or issue the notices because some of the companies, three of them, had furnished their accountability and the fourth was actually in the process of paying the taxes. So court found that the agency notices and the suspension were illegally done, and it relied also on Section 109, which provides that even if the commissioner is required to collect the money, the commissioner is supposed to issue timelines of 14 days. This was not done, and so the agency notices were set aside. Another case which we can now look at is a case involving Housing Finance Bank and URA. In this case, agency notices were issued on an account belonging to a taxpayer. Later on, the taxpayer withdrew the money, so the bank was not able to pay, to make the payments. What URA did was to demand from the bank personally to pay the money. At the hearing, the plaintiff argued that by the time the agency notices had been given to the MD, the money had been withdrawn. It also stated that the tax was not yet due for payment as per the assessment. Secondly, the assessment and the notice had not been served on the taxpayer. The defendant's argument in response was that the bank is personally liable since the agency notices had been served before the money had been withdrawn. So the court made a ruling and found that the agency notices were illegally issued since the taxpayer had never been served with a notice. He only got to know about it in the papers and from the bank. Court also found that the due date for payment had not yet lapsed, so URA was not supposed to collect the money. Court also relied on Section 99 of the Income Tax Act that allows a taxpayer to object to an assessment. This was not followed because a taxpayer is allowed 45 days to object to an assessment. In this case, the assessment had been issued. The date had not yet passed. The taxpayer didn't have an opportunity to file an objection, and the money was, the agency notice was issued. Similarly, in Barivasa case, that was the argument of both parties. And also court found that the defendant should have given the taxpayer 45 days window period within which to object instead of going straight ahead to attach. So these cases that we've handled at the firm have very much influenced the amendments that are in the TPCA. You will all note that previously these provisions were in the ITA, which is the Income Tax Act, and the VAT Act, the East Africa Customs Management Act. These were repealed and put into the TPCA. And in doing that, because of basically some of these challenges the authority was facing in these cases, there were some changes. For example, the requirement that a person will become liable to pay tax wasn't previously there. This means that even if a transaction hasn't taken place, but URA for some reason knows that it will take place and you'll be liable, an agency notice will be issued. It is also now possible for the commissioner to issue a notice as long as he has grounds to believe that you will not pay, that the taxpayer will not pay tax. This means that tax can be collected before the due date. So this wasn't, this was something new. So we'd want to watch out for some of these areas. Thirdly, the Income Tax Act previously had that the notice had to be served at the same time to the taxpayer. While they are serving the banks or the other third party, they had to serve the taxpayer at the same time. The TPCA doesn't expressly state those words. Same time, I quote, same time. So you can serve at any time, maybe even after. Here you can serve the taxpayer maybe after they've issued the agency notice. I mean, that is what is now in the law. Last but not least, in the ITA previously, a person who was served with a notice was able to inform the commissioner whether they will be able to pay the money or whether they are not able to pay. This was, however, eliminated in the TPCA. If you look at the provision that provides for enforcement, this particular provision was removed. So, however, one can utilize the general provision on appealing. In case you don't have the money and you inform the commissioner and the commissioner rejects your notice, you can still appeal through the general provisions, although in this current TPCA was removed. So lastly, the TPCA has also introduced a provision that says that the agency notices that are served on accounts, for example, where one is receiving salary or pension, there should be a limit on the money to be removed, and that is 20% per each payment. So this could be actually a good thing. So let's look at what is happening today on the ground. What is happening today in regards to the requirements? Today's service is being done electronically. through the e-tax on one's portal or even by mail. So if you're a taxpayer and you've been sent an email and you don't know that you've been sent an email, you cannot claim that you are not served. Service can be done by email, and that is also provided for in the TPCA and various other laws that provide for electronic evidence and all. So a number of clients today are issued agency notices when there is actually no assessment, therefore no tax to be paid. In such a case, you would have no option but to just file a TAT application with your agency notice, because you don't have anything else. The agency notice will serve as a taxation decision in itself. Agency notices are still issued, are still being issued before the due date of payment of tax mentioned in the assessments. Agency notices are also sometimes issued when the case is in the process of being heard. This includes even cases that have injunctions. Well, it could be an administrative problem. Why would URA issue out agency notices or carry out enforcements when there is an injunction? There are some other cases that can address that issue that were previously handled. For example, the Stanbic case and also Fuelix case, whereby if URA has violated a court order, URA will be penalized. I think that is the famous Stanbic versus Uganda, where URA was ordered to pay a fine for contempt of court. It violated an interim order. And then in Fuelix, URA was ordered to release the taxpayers' trucks that had been impounded. Court on appeal directed URA to release the trucks before the appeal could be heard. Going forward, taxpayers are usually required to pay 30% prior to appeal or review. However, there are cases where the taxpayer has paid the 30% and URA will issue the agency notice. Sorry. There are also cases where reminders are sent. They send you a final reminder, they give you a timeline. You're in the process of trying to pay, they hit the account with the agency notice. So this is an issue that has to be addressed. Usually the reminder actually comes with the interest. So there are issues, there are other cases where you have a taxpayer having an overdraft facility. Technically, there's no money on the account, but the agency notice will be issued on that account. This will bring in issues of interest because you've now borrowed the money from the bank. This can successfully be challenged in court or through the process in the TPCA. The banks or the taxpayer can alert the commissioner on this issue. Today, most of the agency notices I've seen don't have a date of payment. They usually have a clause that the money should be paid immediately. The case that has handled this issue is the CADA case, where court noted that the section requires that the notice must have immediate date and the money should be paid, and not the statement of immediately. So court in this case found the agency notice to have been illegal. Other circumstances that have been handled by courts concerning agency notices, for example, issues on the right to fair hearing, whereby a party is supposed to be given a chance to be heard in court before an agency notice is issued. This happened in a case, also one that we didn't handle, called Sunday Pande versus URA. Court found that the consent that was signed between URA and the company to transfer liability to a shareholder could not stand because the shareholder was not a party to the case, and they never had a chance to be heard in court, and that anything that is done in violation of the Constitution is a nullity and is not effect. That is all I have for now on agency notices. If you have any questions you'd like to ask or clarify on some issues that I've said, you could send your questions in. Thank you very much. Jackie?
Thank you very much, Dorothy, for that wonderful presentation. There's a question from Mr. Mgabi Ivan, that you have talked of the leeway for URA to collect the tax before the due date. Isn't this likely to result in two cases of ambushing the taxpayer due to lack of tax certainty of when the tax must be paid?
Yes, that is obviously the main problem with this provision. However, maybe you could challenge it in court, because the law clearly states that the commissioner can issue. I mean, if the commissioner knows maybe you're about to leave the country and yet the due date is not, you know, hasn't yet been reached, they can go ahead. This would be something we'd want to challenge in court.
Thank you, Dorothy. The other question is, what happens, because the law says that implies that the third party must comply. So what happens in the event that the third party is unable to comply?
If the third party is unable to comply, you're supposed to write to the commissioner giving the grounds why they're unable to comply. The commissioner is also meant to reply, either rejecting the reasons or approving. But whatever happens, whatever decision comes, if the third party is not comfortable with it, they could utilize the appeal, the general appeal procedures of objection in the TPC.
Okay, thank you very much, Dorothy, for that presentation. We shall now move on to our next topic. The other question for this other topic we just finished on enforcement will be addressed later in the Q&A session. As we all know that each country or state has its own domestic tax system that provides for how it intends to tax its residents and the type of income or activity it wishes to bring into the tax net. Even when a person is not a resident of a particular state, it may nevertheless be earning profits from that state, which are subject to tax under the source principle. The issues of international tax arise where a person is resident in one state and has a right to income or gains in another state. From a country's perspective, both states will want to collect tax to which they believe they're entitled to. From a taxpayer's side, this may lead to double taxation. And then you find that countries have entered into bilateral treaties, commonly referred to as double taxation agreements, which aim at defining in each country a taxpayer will be considered to be resident for tax purposes, and how taxes on different types of income and capital will be shared between the two countries. Uganda currently has 9 double taxation agreements in force with Zambia, the United Kingdom, South Africa, Italy, Denmark, Norway, Mauritius, India, Netherlands, and Belgium. Our next presenter is Mr. Kamsime Oscar. He'll be addressing the application of tax treaties in Uganda. Mr. Kamsime is a senior associate at Birungi Barrett and Associates and has been in practice for over 8 years. Over to you, Oscar.
Yes, thank you very much, Jatu. A double taxation agreement is an agreement signed between sovereign states. It's signed for the purpose of providing relief against double taxation and also to prevent fiscal evasion. Fiscal evasion is also what we know as tax evasion. So the question may be, how then does the double taxation problem come about? The double taxation problem comes about as a result of two principles that give a country the right to tax. The first principle is residence. Residence simply means for an individual that you're domiciled in that country or maybe based on the number of days you spend in that country. For a company, it's that you are incorporated in that country or the management and control of that company takes place in that country. For source, being the second principle, is that basically you make money in another country. Now, as a result of globalization, you find that companies invest across their own borders. That means that a company invests beyond the jurisdiction where it's resident. As a result of that, is that the company will be taxed where it has sourced, where it has invested, and that income can also be taxed where it's resident. And as such, you have the income taxed twice, hence double taxation. And how then do the agreements provide relief? The agreements provide relief based on the principle that one of the countries will forego the tax either in part or in whole. And normally the country that forgoes the tax is the source country. The reason is that it's a trade-off. The source country will get foreign direct investment in exchange for a tax loss or a minimized tax loss. So you forego your tax as a country, and you then, in exchange, get foreign direct investment. Now, how then do the disputes come about? The main cause of the dispute is that you find that some companies want to take advantage of the double taxation agreements. For instance, you find a company incorporated and therefore resident in the United Arab Emirates and wants to invest in Uganda. But Uganda does not have a double taxation treaty with the United Arab Emirates. So what the country may do, be go and incorporate a subsidiary with a country that has a double taxation agreement. So you go and incorporate a subsidiary in Netherlands or in the UK, and that subsidiary invests in Uganda, which is a vice also known as treaty shopping, because you are looking out for countries with favorable treaties and using them as vehicles to invest. Secondly, is that sometimes the country is not willing to forego, the source country is not willing to see tax slip through its hands. So for that reason, it will find any excuse to tax that income. And that's how the disputes come about. Let's look at the Target Well control case as an example of the first dispute. Now, Target Well Control Uganda is a subsidiary of Target Well Control UK, and it leased equipment from Target Well Control UK. It made lease payments for the lease of that equipment, but did not withhold income tax on the payments made. Now, URA, upon finding that out, imposed the liability on Target Well Uganda. And in its defense, Target Well Uganda said that this income was not liable to tax based on the agreement between the UK and Uganda. And that under Article 7 of that agreement, Uganda agreed to forego the revenue, save for circumstances where there is a permanent establishment. Now, a permanent establishment simply means some sort of physical presence. You either have a branch, you have a workshop, you have an office in that country. So as an exception, income generated for that from that branch should be taxed by the source country. So back to Targetwell, is that Targetwell, the defense was there was no branch and therefore no permanent establishment, and therefore it was not liable. Targetwell UK was not liable to the tax, and therefore Targetwell Uganda was also not liable to withhold. The judge noted that yes, double taxation agreements take precedence over domestic legislation when it comes to matters of tax. And in this case, the double taxation agreement between Uganda and UK was clear under Article 7 that profits sourced from one country are only to be taxed by the country of residence. And the judge also determined that there was no permanent establishment based on the relationship between Targetwell UK and Targetwell Uganda. In other words, that Targetwell UK was trading with Targetwell Uganda and not trading through Targetwell Uganda. Therefore, Targetwell Uganda had some degree of independence, and as such, it was not a permanent establishment of Targetwell UK. So, but there is an exception to the rules when it comes to still the source country having a right to tax, is that the countries under the domestic law can put in place exceptions that prevent a company or a person from benefiting from a double taxation agreement, which is the case we're going to look at next. That is the case of White Sapphire and Crane Bank versus Uganda Revenue Authority. Now, White Sapphire is a company incorporated under the laws of Mauritius and a shareholder in Crane Bank. Crane Bank issued dividends and charged withholding tax at a rate of 10% based on the double taxation agreement between Mauritius and Uganda. URA insisted that the tax should have been charged at 15% and not 10%. So the issues then before court was whether White Sapphire was, whether Article 10 of the double taxation agreement was applicable to White Sapphire. And secondly, is that whether Section 88.5 of the Income Tax Act was also applicable in the circumstances. Now, Section 88.5, what we shall come back to, is the exception. Now, under Article 10 of the Double Taxation Agreement between Mauritius and Uganda, is that the source country would forego in part. In other words, that the source country, when taxing a beneficial owner, would limit the tax to 10%. URA argued that this was not applicable to White Sapphire because the owner of White Sapphire was resident in Kenya. Because White Sapphire was owned by an individual, and that individual owned the entire shareholding, which is 100%. So in the circumstances, that article was not applicable. But the judge held that the article was applicable to White Sapphire. So now if the article was applicable to White Sapphire, then was also Section 88.5 applicable in the circumstances? Section 88.5, as it was then, it limited enjoyment of rights under double taxation agreement to the extent that only a shareholder, a beneficial owner, who has no controlling interest could take benefit of the double taxation agreement. A controlling interest means that you have a majority say in the company, and under Section 88.5 as it was then, is that if you held more than 50%, it would mean you are a controlling stakeholder. But the double taxation agreement had a proviso to the effect that if a state wants to limit the enjoyment of the right to be taxed at 10%, then the limitations to be put in place can only be put in place upon mutual agreement between the two states. Therefore, Uganda could not then unilaterally impose qualifications for you to be a beneficial owner. The judge decided that Section 88.5, as it was then, was applicable. But then it was an issue of procedure. Under the double taxation agreement, it was agreed between Uganda and Mauritius that if you want to limit the rights of an individual, then it must be by mutual agreement. And then the double taxation agreement has what we call a mutual agreement procedure. So the mutual agreement procedure is simply that the maybe the URA of here, the competent authority, maybe URA, maybe Minister of Finance, engages the competent authority in another jurisdiction. And this, in order to solve a problem or to bring into limitations into force. Now, the judge decided that the duty to follow the mutual agreement procedure is on URA. And therefore, that even White Sapphire should not have come to court in the first place, because under the same article, if White Sapphire was aggrieved by a decision of a competent authority, it would have to go and report to its to the competent authority in its jurisdiction. So what we learn from this case is the issue of mutual agreement procedure. And mutual agreement procedure is not without imperfections or limitations. One is that it is very bureaucratic, and sometimes you don't know who the competent authority is. So if the competent authority is Minister of Finance, for instance, in the Republic of Mauritius, is that URA will have to engage Minister of Finance in Uganda, to engage Minister of Finance in Mauritius, to also therefore engage Minister of Finance, the taxing authority in Mauritius. So because of that bureaucracy, you find that countries are hesitant to follow the mutual agreement procedure. It's also notable that the law has since been changed. During the course of White Sapphire, the law has changed in as far as Section 88.5 is concerned, to give a new definition of beneficial owner and provide exceptions to who the beneficial owner would be. And it's plausible that the change could have been as a result of cases like White Sapphire, which appeared to URA to be issues of treaty abuse. So the new Section 88.5 now puts in place two factors. One is that you must be a beneficial owner within the definition of the agreement. Secondly, is that you must have economic activity in that state. Relating this to White Sapphire is that the argument by URA was that White Sapphire had no economic activity in Mauritius. It was simply holding company incorporated in Mauritius to take advantage of the double taxation agreement between Mauritius and Uganda. With that, I would like to conclude and say thank you very much for your attention. Back to you, Jackie.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kamtine, for that wonderful presentation on double taxation agreements. Just a few questions before we move on. Please confirm which law takes precedence. Is it the double taxation agreement or domestic tax law?
Yes, the double taxation agreement takes precedence, except where there is treaty abuse. So under Section 82, the double taxation agreement takes precedence, but Section 88.2, is subject to Section 88.5. So if you are not abusing, as it was the case in Targetwell, that means the domestic law will take precedence. But if you're seen to be treaty shopping, then you can, Targetwell, the DTA. But if you're seen to be treaty shopping, then the domestic law will take precedence.
Okay, thank you for that. The other question is, there seems to be an unfair advantage for persons enjoying both the DTA incentive and the traditional incentive regime in the Uganda tax code. Do you think this creates some form of unfairness legally?
Person enjoying both DTA
The person enjoying both the DTA incentives under the double taxation agreement, and the traditional incentive regime, that is the domestic incentives offered by the government. Is there a form of unfairness legally?
If I'm to understand it this way, Uganda may have incentives that attract investment. So a treaty shopper will go and incorporate where the Uganda has a DTA and come and take advantage of this incentive. Now that is, it is in essence unfair, but may not necessarily be illegal. That's my answer.
All right, one last one. Is there a possibility that FDI benefit is less than the tax income lost under the DTA, say in a short term? What specific benefits accrue to the host country from the FDI?
That is a debatable question, and it's what has led some countries like Uganda, maybe to suspend some double taxation agreements and renegotiate them. Say that it does not mean that investor would have come in. So it should not come because of the DTA. So that undermines the issue of foreign direct investment as a driver for DTAs.
Okay, Oscar would like to know, can a taxpayer participate in the negotiation process when it comes to MAP?
In my opinion, no. These are matters of the state, of the states. So unless the state is so democratic that the process would include the populace or the taxpayers. Let's take an example of legislation in Uganda, is that if they're going to enact an income tax amendment, there may be a stakeholders engagement, whereby Parliament engages with stakeholders, they give their views, then that's taken into consideration. But now, when it comes to matters between states in the national law, is that it's the state actors. It is an issue of the state actors. So the participation of the taxpayer is limited.
All right, thank you very much, Oscar. Over to you, Amanda.
Thank you, Jackie. Thank you, Oscar. Now we come to our final panelist. Our final panelist is Mr. Rurungi Cephas. He's the managing partner at Rurungi Barrett and Associates. He has a twofold tax experience as a taxman with URA for 20 years and has been in legal practice for over 15 years. He's going to be addressing the treatment of leases and premiums. And briefly, for income tax purposes, tax is charged on the gross income of a person less any allowable deductions. And deductions are the expenditures and losses incurred by a person in the production of business. In particular, specifically, he's going to be talking about allowable deductions in relation to persons carrying on real estate businesses. Thank you, Mr. Rinji. Please go for it. Please take us through, Mr. Rinji.
Thank you, Amanda. Welcome, our dear attendees, and thank you, panelists, for the presentations well made. Today, as we have been told, we are talking about two cases which discuss something very similar. The matter in issue was whether rental expenses and premiums paid on leases are allowable deductions. The background to it is that some basic accounting, very basic accounting, is that before you arrive at tax, you look at the gross income or total revenue, deduct expenses, and the balance, which is sometimes called profit, but is called chargeable income under income tax because there are specific allowances, which may not necessarily be the case in financial accounting. So you arrive at the chargeable income. So before arriving at chargeable income, there are some deductions which became very contentious. And the deductions in this case were rent and premiums arising from leases. So the leases in this case, the first case, the Mukwano Enterprise, is a company well known all over Uganda, one of the biggest real estate enterprises. And it acquired leases from different entities like Uganda Land Commission, Uganda Land Board, for Kabarole District Administration and other district boards. These were leases for periods ranging from 49 to 99 years. And so as you may be familiar with leases, they normally provide for a premium, normally paid once upon execution, and leases which are paid over a long time, over the duration of the lease. So in accounting treatment, the accountants considered that the whole amount paid for a specific lease, say if a lease was for 49 years and rental paid over each year is say 1 million shillings, which is 49 million shillings. In many cases, this 49 million is paid once at the beginning together with the premium. So assuming you have paid 49 million and then 1 million as premium, so you have paid a total of 50 million shillings. So the accountant spread this 50 million over the length of that lease, 49 years, and each year deducted a 50th of that amount. So every year they considered that 1 million as an allowable expense. During the audit, the URA disallowed this expense and considered it as a capital expense, therefore not allowable. The law which was relied on is Section 22 of the Income Tax Act, which has two provisions which cover this area, which were the basis of their decision. The first section is that what is allowed is income, what is allowed in arriving at chargeable income are expenses which are incurred in the production of income. That is 22.1A. And the revenue considered that the rental and premium expenses are not incurred in the production of income. The other provision which was relied on is section 22.2 of the Income Tax Act, which provides that no deduction is allowed for expenditure or loss of a capital nature, and any amount included in the cost base of an asset. So the argument was that either way, the rental and premium expenses are not incurred in production of income. They are of a capital nature, and they are included in the cost base. It is also important to note that in the accounting treatment, the accountants considered that these expenses are operating leases, and that under IAS, the accounting practice, accounting standard IAS 17, leases are supposed to be amortized over the period of the expenses are supposed to be amortized over the period of the lease. So that was the underlying argument of the applicants, Mukwano. So Mukwano was saying this rental is a normal revenue expense. It is not a capital expense. It is only that it is paid in one lump sum. Otherwise, it is a revenue expense. The revenue authority had another argument that this same enterprise, Mukwano, had rather a sister enterprise of this Mukwano, another Mukwano, had had a similar matter in the tribunal in the case of 2008, which was dismissed on the same ground where leases were considered to be not an allowable deduction. So those were the considerations underlying the dispute. And in looking at what is considered to be revenue and capital expenses, both parties to the case cited very many cases, many authorities abroad and local, to confirm on behalf of URA that these leasehold expenses are capital expenses which are not allowable. And one of the leading cases on this is the Asserton case, which is a well-known case by all persons who have dealt in taxes. It is Asserton versus British Insulated and Helsby Cables, which says that capital expenditure is a thing that is going to be spent once and for all. And income expenditure is a, so a number of principles were coming up. One is that when you have something, when you spend it once in, or if you can prove that you have spent it once and for all, then it is capital. So that was a principle in the Asserton case. And that Asserton was quoting, following other cases like Vodafone Cellular, which also says where a lump sum payment was made to a commute or extinguish a controversial obligation to make recurring payments, the payment was prima facie a revenue expense. So that was the argument of the applicant. So the tests was whether there is an enduring benefit, whether there is a lump sum payment, but in arriving at its decision, the revenue was of the view, just give me a minute, sorry, some technical issue here.
Sorry about that. Just to recap what he's talking about. Every company which is doing a business incurs certain costs in the production of its income. And to this income, before it's charged tax, certain deductions are allowed. And this is what this company incurred while deducting its costs in the production of income. So therefore, if a company is dealing in real estate and they incur costs due to a lease, how is income tax charged on those costs? Do you deduct the cost for acquiring that lease, or do you add them? Are they part of the are they not allowed? Do they also get charged tax? So that's what
I'm continuing
with about. Back to you, Mr. Renji.
Sorry about that technical hitch. Apologies. I hope you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
The main consideration of the tribunal in arriving at its decision was that considering the nature of business of Mukwano, the expenditure is an expenditure is one of the capital nature if it is paid for acquisition of a capital asset and not stock in trade. That the land transactions were the modus operandi and land or leases were the stock in trade of Mukwano Enterprises. It also ruled that any expenses incurred in acquiring the leases are revenue in nature and therefore are allowable deductions. The tribunal also went ahead to say that the IAS 17 is not applicable because where the act is clear, the accounting standards cannot override the act, and that the expenses should not be amortized, which had been the case, but they should be allowed as a one-off. The matter was referred back to the URA for reconsideration under Section 19 of the Tax Appeals Tribunal Act. Now, this case is quite interesting for the reason that it followed the Vivo Energy decision, which was made by the same tribunal and was made to a different effect in that ultimately in Vivo, the tribunal disallowed rent and premium. But in Vivo, the rent and premium were disallowed as being capital of the capital nature for different reasons. First of all, based on the facts of Vivo, is that Vivo obtained leases for purposes of setting up petrol stations. And also, similar to Mukwano, obtained leases from different entities, including land commission and district boards, and from individuals. So when you are audited, it also found like the same facts of Mukwano and said that these were capital expenses which were not allowable. Next slide. So the dispute at the tribunal was simply whether the rent and premiums were deductible expenses. And ultimately, the tribunal decided that these were not allowable expenses. It said that because the nature of business of Vivo was fuel business, because the nature of business of Vivo Energy was fuel business, therefore, the leases were not the stock in trade of its business. It said the revenue expenditures incurred to maintain the business and benefit the current expenditure, while capital expenditures are incurred to benefit future periods. In other words, that the expenditures on the leases were for long-term benefit. They were of an enduring nature, that they were not used to produce the incomes of that period. So if one was producing, was dealing in the sale of fuel, a 49-year lease was not considered to be a revenue item. And then it said that unlike a rent agreement, the premium and rent paid for leases grants the taxpayer rights of ownership of the fixed asset. That the land was leased for long term and leases conferred interest on the applicant in the land, which was of a capital nature. So clearly, on the surface, when looking at it, one would only find that the reason why there was a main difference between the two decisions was that the two entities were doing business of a very different nature. So leases were fundamental to the business of real estate as circulating capital, while for fuel business, the leases were long-term nature because the main business was selling fuel. So Vivo Energy was not satisfied with this decision and appealed to the commercial court, which then reversed the decision. And if you read the decision of the commercial court, it goes into some interesting arguments defining premiums, defining rent, and distinguishing premiums from rent. What is more interesting is that the appellants, Vivo Energy, when they went to the commercial court, they conceded the part of premiums. So they argued that since premiums are paid as a one-off, they are actually capital in nature, which is quite different from the Mukwano Enterprises case. So in the Mukwano Enterprises case, the applicants did not concede the premium, and the tribunal also did not distinguish between premium and rent, because it argued that if you read Section 2 of the Income Tax Act, the definition of rent actually includes premium. So how you treat premium should follow how you treat rent. And the High Court ruling, go back to the previous slide. So the High Court ruling was to the effect that rent is a recurrent expenditure that is paid to maintain occupants of leased facilities. It is paid to maintain the revenue generating capacity derived from possessing of the lease. The commercial court also went into the definition of a lease under the Land Act and was of the firm decision that a lease means that you finally hand over that land to the person who leased to you. Therefore, you do not have ultimate ownership. Therefore, if you do not have ultimate ownership, you cannot say you have a capital asset because eventually you will lose it. So both cases confirm the position that each case has got to be decided on its own facts. And the tribunal said, in the absence of statutory definition, every time the question comes up, the peculiarity of the circumstances and the facts of each case make this determination of the distinction ever uniquely challenging, despite the well-established persuasive positions put forth in the various court decisions. Meaning, ultimately, that it will be difficult for anybody to just wave around the case of Vivo or the case of Mukwano in their circumstances without addressing the peculiarities of their business. Because any scholar looking at this will quite easily see a number of apparent contradictions. But all the cases which have been decided on this matter recognize that there will be contradictions because each business is different. What you call stock in trade is not easy to define. What you call circulating capital is not easy to define. what you call cost base is also not easy to define, and none of the statutes will actually go to define these terms, because these terms are very dynamic. They are like moving targets. So it becomes interesting, for example, if you look at the ultimate decisions, say the decision in the commercial court on Vivo Energy, saying rent is automatically an allowable expense, premium is not. So if I have a lease, and I agree with my leaser to increase the term rent, minimize lease, premium, or abolish premium completely in my terms of the lease, I definitely wouldn't be acting illegally, but I would be planning properly if I base my decision on the decisions of the tribunal and the commercial court. So this is an interesting area. And of course, when you look at the fact that the tribunal said IAS 17 doesn't apply, and yet you recognize that the accounting part is as important as the interpretation part. Basically, URA works based on financial statements. So how can you oust the provisions of IAS 17, especially when you recognize that Section 43 also of the Income Tax Act provides for amortization without using those exact words, that it recognizes prepayments, saying if an expenditure moves beyond 13 months, then it can be amortized, it can be spread through the periods of the duration of that expenditure. So I find that there is a lot of important talking points in the two cases. And as the other international cases indicate, this is always a matter which cannot be concluded by precedent. I thank you for listening to me.
Thank you so much, Mr. Rinji. We have a question here. Would the decision in Mukwano have been different if Mukwano was not doing real estate as its core business? Do you think the decision would have been different if real estate was not its core business?
Well, if you look at the result, you can say no, but a lot of these cases depend on how they're argued. So it could have been real estate, but could have been argued differently. As I've indicated earlier, there was another Mukwano case, which was a 2000 case. But in that case, the angle of attack was a different provision, which was Section 30 about intangible asset. So instead of going through the decision of rental and premium, in that case, the same facts were applied to attain the result of a deduction based on an intangible asset rather than on the result of a total deduction as a full allowable expense. And as you can see, also the pleadings matter, because if you look at Vivo Energy, it was immediately conceded that premiums are actually capital assets. Yet in the tribunal, that wasn't necessarily the case. And yet, in the very commercial court, you find that it was the finding of the court that the definition of rent in the Income Tax Act is very material in as far as premium is under rent. And yet that same court said premium is not allowable. So it's quite interesting and not necessarily predictable, but that is the nature of litigation.
Yes, thank you. Another question here. The rest of the questions will be answered in the general Q&A, but a last question for you is whether a lease can be defined as an intangible asset under IFRS 16. I think that was the matter in Kwano Industries, not Enterprise, but someone is asking for that clarification.
Thank you. First of all, I don't have the benefit of reading properly IAS 16. And I think it is something which I would make a finding ultimately. But the point is that in the Mukwano Enterprises case, the Mukwano Industries case, 2008 case, decided that the expenditure relating to the leases was not an intangible asset. Whether it was following the line of IS 16 is a different matter. So as I've indicated, it depends on how you argue your case. So it could have failed to be an intangible asset in that case, based on the fact that maybe they didn't argue IS 16 properly. But much as in this case, the applicants were satisfied with the decision of the tribunal, or rather found it favorable, they are not necessarily satisfied that IS 17 didn't apply or that accounting standards are not applicable, because it is the feeling of the applicant that Section 43 on prepayment actually is another name for recognition of accounting standard if you recognize amortization.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for your presentation. Thank you so much for that. Let's go back to Jackie. She'll handle that, the Q&A session.
Thank you very much to all our panelists and Amandla for coordinating that session. Question to Dorothy. URA is often quick to place an agency notice on a taxpayer, but in the event that the notice was illegally issued, the process of recovering the fund is very long. How can this be mitigated? Dorothy?
Maybe if I could answer.
Yes, Oscar, please go ahead.
Thank yes.
Yes, Oscar, please go ahead. Oscar?
Yeah, getting back the money takes some level of goodwill from URA. And the other point is that if you secure the order, if you get the order that your money should be refunded, then you should enforce that as an order of court, such that it being an unconditional order, URA won't then say that, but you have another liability here. So if the court would have then ordered that that money be refunded to you, then you enforce that as an order of court, which of course may also have this challenge as well.
Okay, thank you very much, Oscar. Belinda. This is to you. Don't issues of seditious books come across as largely difficult concept? Because a book might be a political kind of book, but labeled seditious and placed under some unfavorable rating.
Thank you, Jackie. In regards to that, if URA finds it offensive, then a party has to go before the tribunal for that to be considered. Because what may not be seditious to one may be seditious to another. So I think there's a thin line on that, and it can only be decided by the tribunal what constitutes seditious and what doesn't constitute seditious.
Okay. The other question is, on the Florence Agreement, did the tribunal acknowledge the Florence Agreement as an international agreement for tax, because the Income Tax Act stipulates what constitutes an international agreement under Section 8.
Thank you for that. I think that was Ferdinand. Under Section 88 and Section 78, that is the Income Tax Act, and then 76 of the VAT Act, they actually talk about international agreements. And they say that these international agreements constitute an agreement entered into the government of Uganda and foreign countries or an institute. In this regard, the Florence Agreement is a UN treaty. Uganda signed it in 1965 and it was ratified in our laws in 2005. And if you look at the conditions under Section 76 of the VAT Act, it says that international agreements take precedent, but they must be ratified into the Ugandan law. So if that is taken care of, then it means that the agreement is enforceable in Uganda. And indeed, the tribunal considered all these aspects and confirmed that the Florence Agreement is applicable in Uganda as it had been ratified and also signed by Uganda, and Uganda is a party to the treaty. So yes, it is. It was confirmed by the tribunal based on that.
Thank you very much, Belinda. To Oscar. What lessons of double taxation does Uganda's taxation jurisprudence advance from the White Sapphire case?
Yes, the White Sapphire case emphasizes an issue of following mutual agreement procedure and the duty to follow mutual agreement procedure. So what we learned from White Sapphire is that the duty is upon you to follow mutual agreement procedure. And therefore, before you are can tax you, if you are based in a country of the DTA, and there is procedure under that DTA, you should first follow that procedure before it can tax you.
Okay, Oscar, the other question to you is, in F-19, the URA made various changes to the provisions of Section 885, further limiting the scope of beneficial owners under DTAs. To what extent does the White Sapphire case invalidate the provisions of the section as it stands now?
The White Sapphire case would not invalidate the provision. Even the old provision, as it was then, the judge found it applicable to White Sapphire. What the URA is doing now is to expand the definition of the limitation so as to curb people who have been taking advantage of the loopholes in the laws that we had. For instance, you find that in some countries, for you to have a controlling stake, you need only 25%. But in Uganda, we are known to having a threshold of 50%. So the key principle in White Sapphire is a mutual agreement procedure. And there's no amendment that can take away that principle of mutual agreement procedure unless the law says that I can tax you before following mutual agreement procedure. Back to you, Jackie.
Thank you very much, Oscar. Back to you, Dorothy. How are agency notices dealt with in situations where they are issued at a time when a taxpayer is insolvent? Dorothy? Dorothy, the question to you is, how are agency notices dealt with in situations where they are issued at a time when a taxpayer is in an insolvent state and the insolvency practitioner is devising means of at least settling priority payments, including URA?
Thank you, Jackie. Where a taxpayer is insolvent, usually what you'll be required to do is to approach URA, Uganda Revenue Authority, and give them your reasons, there will be a way that that issue will be settled.
And then someone wants to know if URA has given any special allowances in this COVID pandemic relating to liability, tax liability.
Sorry, in case URA has done that?
Has given any special allowances on tax liability during this pandemic?
During this pandemic, nothing has been mentioned about agency notices during this pandemic. There is no law that stops URA from issuing the agency notices. Actually, some have been issued, although I cannot disclose because the cases are not yet in court. Cannot disclose the different clients, but yes, agency notices are being issued. So we have to be on the lookout. In case they're issued, you have to find ways of accessing court during this time. There is a provision in the income tax that allows the commissioner to employ methods that can help people. I think that is section 40 of the TPCA. As long as the commissioner deems it fit.
Thank you very much, Dorothy.
Is done now. Thank you.
The next question is for Mr. Virunji. How do you handle payment of rental tax whereby a tenant has lived in your house but not paid your full year's rent? This habit of defaulting midway and has stayed for like a year but paid for 8 months. And also, how do you handle payment of rental tax when property has had a tenant for 2 months out of a calendar year? This means you have earned less than you earlier envisaged. How would you handle this?
Thank you. Thank you, Jackie. That question needs to be understood with the more facts. First of all, is the landlord a company or is it an individual? How much is the landlord earning? And is the landlord earning within the taxable bracket? Is the landlord returning under cash basis of filing or accruals basis? So first of all, you should be earning above 2.8 million shillings a year before you are a taxpayer. 20,000 before you become a taxpayer, earning that in 1 year. So if you are earning below that, then you are below the taxable bracket, and that may have little to do with the URA. Number two, if you are a company and you are filing not necessarily as a rental business, but as a business, then there are different parameters to consider, because then it depends on what is your ultimate profit, which is different from what is your total rent if you are, say, an individual. And if you are accounting on cash basis, say, so you have expecting to earn 3 million shillings in a year, but somebody has defaulted and you have only earned 1.8 million shillings in a year. So that what you report is actually what you received. So you received 1.8 and you are below the taxable bracket. But if you are in accruals accounting, meaning that you reflect what you should have received, so you will have to reflect 3 million and then claim a bad debt for the amount of rent which the tenant has defaulted or has refused to pay. Now, if you prove the bad debt, then it again puts you in a bracket where you shouldn't pay. But bad debts are very difficult to prove under the Income Tax Act, because you are supposed to prove that you have made all reasonable attempts to collect that money and failed. and what constitutes reasonable attempts under the Act means and includes going to court. So in the Ugandan circumstances, you can imagine if somebody defaulted 3 million shillings from you and you decided to go to court, you are very likely to incur expenses which are more than 3 million. So many people would not attempt to follow that. So URA will also say, since you relaxed and you never followed up, we are not going to recognize this as a bad debt. URA could also say, if you allowed somebody in your house for 8 months and didn't collect, then you were not vigilant enough. So it is a question of fact, but it depends, as I said, on how much you actually expected to earn, whether you're in the taxable bracket, and how much effort you made to recover that money. I hope that answers most of it, but as you may tell, the facts are most important. Some other facts may be necessary to explain exhaustively.
Thank you very much, Mr. Birungi, for that. The question from Mr. Wilber, tax treatment, would it be the right tax treatment if any entrepreneur owns the land and decides to use this land as a business premise in which he's a major shareholder? The land is then valued and it is capitalized and amortized over a specific time. As a lease, in effect, the business is a lease and that is a lessee, and the director is the lessee.
What is important to note is that there are provisions in the Income Tax Act and VAT Act, which allow the commissioner to recharacterize a transaction. The purpose of recharacterizing a transaction, according to case law and according to the Income Tax Act, is for the commissioner to satisfy himself or herself that the transactions have an economic meaning, that you are not merely planning to avoid tax. So if you decide to, if you are the owner of land and you lease to yourself and you are a director on the other hand, it depends, first of all, what would have been taxable, which you are trying to change. So the commissioner has to see that the transactions in between do not have a business purpose other than minimizing tax. If they actually have a business purpose, every taxpayer is allowed to plan his business in a manner which minimizes tax. But if they have no business purpose, then the commissioner is entitled to recharacterize so that the transactions or the income reflects what should actually be properly taxable and what is the market way of doing things, what is the proper way of doing things. So sometimes you can overplan and you end up falling in a ditch, and the commissioner would be entitled to recharacterize. So if you have to recharacterize, please do so in a manner which is well planned.
Thank you very much, Mr. Green, for that. There's another question from Mr. Isaac Balukaza. That we realize that we have not had a consistent decision on what exactly amounts to capital and revenue expenses. What are the key benchmarks in your view in determining capital and revenue expenses for computation of deduction? And secondly, don't you think that the question of premium should have been litigated on appeal in the Viva Energy case to improve the jurisprudence on this matter?
Yes, as I said before, first of all, with due respect to counsel who handled Vivo Energy, I'm not supposed to comment too much without knowing the underlying issues. Maybe the quantum was material or any other reason, but looking at it from purely an academic point of view, I think it should have been, it should not have been considered, mainly because our law says rent includes premium. So if rent includes premium and you are using the principle of law that the law must be interpreted strictly as it is, once I have rent as an allowable, I should automatically have premium as an allowable expense. So if I think I saw another question from Juanita asking where these matters are, whether they are appealed or not. So it is likely that the issues of premium and rent might go to the Court of Appeal or even the Supreme Court. And if I'm involved, I would still go by the strict definition in Section 2 to say that once rent is considered to be a revenue expense, one, should be allowable. Two, in the fact that it has been paid once or in a lump sum should not change its composition, its character. I'm paying for rent, so if I paid for 20 years rent, unless the law was made in such a way that it distinguishes between rent and lease, then I should take the benefit. And some cases have been cited by the Commercial Court in this respect. There's a case called Enterprising Enterprises versus Deputy Commissioner of Income Tax, an Indian case, which says where payments were split, it was held that the proportionate lease rent of acquiring the lease rights for extracting minerals from the underground was a revenue expense. So this was quite similar to what we have in this case. So the prepayment should not change the nature of the transaction, because on the one hand, if you are the recipient of the rent, unless you are an exempt entity like Uganda Land Commission, if you are an individual, URA will be interested in that income in the lump sum. So if it was a lease receipt from a taxable entity, URA wouldn't argue that we are going to receive this income, to recognize this income on a year-to-year basis. They will be very eager to receive all of it the year you are paid. So on the side of the payer, I would also say that I've only made advance payments, which makes it convenient to me, but each installment can be attributed to a specific year. And that also Section 43 entitles me to get that deduction. So back to Mr. Warukaga, the definition cannot be cast in stone. And I don't think it's in the interest of the lawyers that it should be cast in stone, because there are so many variations based on the business. The enduring benefit test does not actually help the taxpayer so much. That is the Asserton case. The lump sum payment test, a one-off payment, has actually been dissected by the same commercial court, Justice Wejuri, to say having paid in a lump sum doesn't make it a capital expense, which is for the benefit of the taxpayer. So the stock in trade issue remains a thin line depending on what you are doing. So this is not an area where I think the statute will manage to define capital items, property or revenue items. So it will allow the lawyers to remain in business.
All right, we have run out of time, but we shall have one more question still to Mr. Virunji. Approved commercial buildings are allowed for industrial building allowance of 5% when you are computing rental taxable amount of a company. Is 5% industrial building allowance allowed as deductible on approved commercial buildings?
Thank you. The issue of approved industrial buildings is governed by a statutory instrument. So the statutory instrument defines what qualifies. And what it says is that it has industrial buildings, it has approved hotels, it has approved hospitals, it has approved commercial buildings. So each of these is defined separately. For example, an approved hotel is a 10-bedroom facility with bedding and toilet and bath and shower room and a restaurant. Approved hospital has a specialized institutional industrial building manned by a fully registered specialist or general practitioner. So approved commercial building is an approved commercial building, is an industrial building which is primarily used by the owner or let out for rent for purposes of carrying on business, trade or profession, or an office or a warehouse or a workshop. And it says, for avoidance of doubt, an approved commercial building does not include a building let out or used for residential accommodation. So it is not that to arrive at the right conclusion, you actually have to look at the statutory instrument and analyze where each of those businesses falls. So you might have a property, but then how, for what purpose is it used is important to arrive at whether you qualify for the 5% deduction.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Birungi. Our attendees, unfortunately, we have come to the end of our webinar. We still had so many questions for our panelists, but we know we have taken much of your time. And once again, thank you so much for staying with us and attending our webinar. We look forward to having similar engagements with you in future. We propose that in case of any queries regarding this webinar, you can contact us through our email, which is info@taxconsultants.co.ug. info@taxconsultants.co.ug. Our phone number is 041-434-8669. We are located at Plot 14 Archer Road, Kololo, and we shall be ready to attend to you. Currently, we are remotely. Please drop your questions through that email and we shall attend to them. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you, our panelists. Thank you, Amandla, for moderating. We wish you a good afternoon and stay safe.
Hello?
We're waiting for the attendees to go off. one more.
Jacket now, okay.
Okay, and there's one more still on, eh?
Right, I've removed them.
Zero. Nothing anymore.
Okay, yeah, zero. No, it's okay.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. This was really good. I received feedback on my phone, my emails, and I think all the topics were handled very well and the key issues tackled. Then we've also had some people asking whether we have anything like a journal with all these precedents. We were able to inform them that we actually have a compendium, and we asked for their contact, so we shall be able to reach to them and sell our compendiums. Yeah, but thank you so much. Let's now hear from the rest of the team.
Thank you, everyone. I think this was a nice presentation, and like Jackie said, the feedback I'm getting from people also is very good, and they say that we should actually present more on tax litigation, and they are happy that we simplified tax litigation to them. Thank you all. This was great.
Without some, because some people are calling me, so what were you saying?
I was saying that we have received good feedback from some of the attendees. Yes, and it has also kind of also worked in terms of marketing and business. There are some people asking whether we have a journal where we have documented these precedents, and we informed them that we actually have a compendium that has more tax cases, and we asked for their details so that we are able to meet them or send to them the compendium. Yeah. And Belinda was also addressing us on her feedback from her people.
Okay, let me address. Ken, kindly block the attendees because some people are joining again. Just give me a minute, please. Okay, thank you, Ken. Sorry, some attendee had logged on again, so I was just saying before you continue. As also in reference to Jackie, I was saying that people have actually enjoyed. I'm actually even receiving emails right now about them. Ken, Amanda Lai had drafted a feedback form. I think you can, I don't know if you got all the emails of the attendees and we just send them that reply. And then we can also attach the presentation because most of them are interested in the presentation. I don't know if that can be done.
Yeah, that can be done.
Okay. And I was saying also, thank you for everyone for participating. This was really good. And people are happy that we have simplified tax litigation to them. Yes.
We have other